Hello, everybody. Merry Christmas. Welcome to a special episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm joined by one of my favorite creators and a friend, somebody I've known before he won. What is it? 8, 9 Eisners now?
I would count, but yeah, it's 7.
I did a count. We're going to talk about that a little bit. I'm curious if you can name all your Eisners. But if you didn't recognize the voice, everybody, it's Tom King. Welcome back to the show, man. It's good to see you.
What a pleasure. How nice to see you. It's just nice to see a friendly face in the midst of the plague, man. It's awesome.
Yeah.
Thanks for it. And yeah, Merry Christmas. My favorite holiday of the year. I am super excited. I've got 3 children, so my house is all Christmas.
Yeah, we're giant Christmas fans here. Tom can probably see the Christmas tree behind. We have 4 full-size Christmas trees, and my wife goes all out. And it's
4 full-size. Oh, we have 1. Oh, now I think a slacker. Thanks. Gotta call me out.
Yeah, and the mini, like I said, yeah, we definitely go all out. But Tom, I wanted to start off. Let's start off on a positive note, spread some good cheer. I know 2020 has been a rough year. We were talking about it before we started recording. What are some of the things you are grateful for this year? What are some of the good things that happened in 2020? Let's focus on the positive here. What's been great for you this year?
I mean, that's, as we see, my kids are screaming in the background. I mean, that's the weird part of the year for me. And I know this isn't true for everyone, but this is one of those years you could look at either way. Like it's a glass half empty year. Like on the one hand, you know, we're in the midst of plague and it's almost like a horrible time to be alive because it's terrible to witness what's going on. On the other hand, I've been fortunate and blessed enough that my family is doing all right, and my we're all happy and healthy, and my 3 kids are doing well, and my father's doing well, my in-laws are okay. I'm nothing but grateful for that. So, I mean, just starting off with the fact that at this point, and, you know, having gone through 10 months of this, that we're still sort of surviving, that we're getting through it. That's the biggest positivity of the whole year. Sometimes it's just positive to be alive at the end of a thing, if this is the end of it. So let's just start with that. I feel that's, to me, it's insane. But, I mean, in general, it's hard to think of it. I mean, I always said in the very beginning of this, I remember talking to Jim Lee on the phone about sort of what it was going to be like and going over it. And I said, we had to remember that 1918 was followed by the Roaring Twenties. And I feel like at this point in the year, we can kind of see over the horizon and see those Roaring Twenties coming. So mm-hmm. To me, that's almost the best part of it. Like there is in my mind that after this gets through with this, we're going to have, there's so much fun that's coming. Like we're going to be so grateful for what we had. We're going to go out, we're going to party, we're going to drink, we're going to go to the movie theater. We're going to be like, the life that's coming looks so good to me right now that I'm just almost salivating over it. So that's 2 things. And I guess the third thing is like a lot of parents, having my kids home 24/7 is annoying. But it's also kind of nice. You know, I work from home normally, so in terms of work-wise, I didn't change that much. But to be able to go to lunch and my kids are there and hang out with them, and my wife is home. My wife is a lawyer here in D.C., so she's never, she didn't have lunch with me. She doesn't have breakfast. So yeah, I really do feel like I've gotten closer to my family during this whole thing, and that's actually been really sweet, that part of it.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way. You know, my wife, she's an accountant. She's working from home right now. I'm working from home, And yeah, it's the same thing. It's like now whenever she leaves just to go, you know, to the store. I mean, we only leave for absolutely the essentials, but she'll leave to go to the store. She's gone for like 45 minutes. I'm like, I already missed her. It's like usually it's 8 hours, if not more, during the day where you're apart. It's kind of weird. But you mentioned, you know, normally you work from home, right? That's a life of a writer, life of a freelancer. So
this is my office. You're staring at it right now. This is where the magic happens.
Yeah, in a lot of ways that hasn't changed, and that's true for a lot of creatives. And I think to your point of what's coming on the horizon and things we can look forward to, you know, we had that big announcement the other day, Disney Plus, all these amazing kind of nerdy, geeky things coming. And then I kind of feel the same way for comics, people not traveling, not spending as much money on going out and eating. I feel like we've had a resurgence of you know, people getting back into comics, and you know, all you comic creators, you know, working hard to have new things coming. Do you feel like that's true? I mean, we haven't had conventions this year, obviously, but we've been doing a lot of things virtually. Where do you feel like the comic industry is, and how do you feel like, are you positive about what's coming up? What are your thoughts and feelings there?
Well, let me speak just for myself personally first, because I have some expertise on it, and then I'll just do guessing on the rest of it. For myself, this has been incredibly productive in terms of creativity. I've been doing a script a week for 10 months or so, since what, March? Mm-hmm. Usually these things are interrupted by conventions, by something. And then just almost just psychologically to get through the week, just doing something that produces something so that not every week isn't the same, mm-hmm. has really almost kept me sane. And I've almost clung to being the best writer I can be as a way to sort of just get through it. I've already written, Batcat, I've already written Rorschach, I've already written Strange Adventures, I've written the series that's next, hasn't even been announced yet. The screenplay for New Gods, this like movie thing or TV thing. I've just been writing nonstop, and you never know till 20 years later than even then, but it seems okay to me. Like, I seem like I'm on my game, hopefully. And so from that aspect, it's been great. I'm fortunate to be working for DC Comics. When this whole thing first started, again, I already dropped his name once, but we asked Jim, what are the marching orders for the comic book stores are closed? They closed for 3 months. Our marching orders were get ahead, like this is our chance to just we are not going to stop. We are unlike 90% of the entertainment industry. We don't require personal interaction to do creativity, which you can't say for people who have to like film stuff. The only personal interaction it takes is in comics is someone walking into a store to buy it and a truck driver agreeing to pick it up from a factory. Like, that's it. Those are the only two social interactions. So because of that, we can keep making content quicker and faster than a lot of these other. So our orders were just boom, go, 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 go. And I've been, I don't know, clinging is the right word, but I've been, thank goodness for that sort of, that DC comic kind of, that was our motto. In terms of my own sales, they've been great. Strange Adventures is doing really well. It's gotten those Mr. Miracle numbers, which is really nice for a very, a superhero even more obscure than Mr. Miracle, and a story that is not as heartwarming as Mr. Miracle. It's a much little more like more of a sour story. And Rorschach, of course, was a big seller, and then Batcat even outsold Rorschach. So the sales are good, and people seem to be eager and back in the stores. Again, speaking for me personally, one of the things that makes my life great now is getting stuff in the mail and buying books online and getting deliveries. And when that Amazon box comes or that local comic book store box comes, it's just like, yeah, man, that's, I live for that. I collect comic art, so I've been buying a ton of art. And I think a lot of people have been doing that. I've been, our minds have been going back to collecting and to sort of gathering and sort of, and since comics, we live off that stuff. I mean, we're an industry of dudes and women who our first instinct was not social. Like, that's changed a little bit as we've moved forward, but in general, that's what it means to be a nerd. That your first instinct is not to sort of go out with a crowd and have super fun. Your first instinct is to be in a corner and imagine a world inside your mind. Like, there are kids that are like that. I have some kids. I have kids that go the other way. But the kids that are like that, who are like me, are drawn to this industry, are drawn to the collecting aspect of it, are drawn to the universe aspect of it, are drawn to the escapist aspect of it. And I think more people have experienced sort of that lifestyle of like, okay, if a lot of our social life is gone, then comics become even more important, I think.
Yeah, it kind of reminds you, you get some nostalgia for it. As you know, nobody gets into creating comics to get rich or to become famous. If you're out there and you're an aspiring creator and that's what you're thinking, man, choose a different field.
I've made a good living. Don't listen to him.
Well, I mean, it's true, but that is the exception rather than the rule. I'm just saying, go in it, and I think most comic creators do. They go in it because they're fans of it.
Oh yeah.
So,
I don't think I've ever met a successful creator who came in to like, this is where I want to make money, or this is where I want to, just because I want to get into TV, but I'm going to start in comics. I don't think I've ever meant that.
No, I haven't either. It's all people who love comics, and then it goes the other way too. People that started out in TV or film, I just recently, we had a Kickstarter spotlight recently with a Brazilian creator, Felipe Cogno, and he went to film school in Brazil and then Chapman University here for film, and then eventually transitioned into comics because he realized that's where his passion was. He still does a little bit of film stuff, but it's comics first. And, you know, I think that's true of a lot of comic creators. So I agree with you 100%. Like right now, if we can't go out and be social, then yeah, we're spending money on comics. Like, oh, I don't have to save money for vacation. I'm going to, like me, I worked on my Amazing Spider-Man run. I have from like 200 up till the present now.
See, wasn't that, yeah, I love collecting, man. I love, I know it's a stupid thing to love because it sounds very, I don't know, materialistic, but it's fun to be like, have a stupid goal. Like I'm going to get a complete this and then like to go out and find it and to hunt for it. And because we're all stuck on the internet, you can hunt in so many different little corners of the internet. And I collecting is one of the things that's kept me sane that throughout my whole life, but especially during this last year.
Yeah. And again, you know, we're both of us super grateful and blessed that we, you know, have jobs that allow us to do that. I know a lot of people are kind of in a hard place right now. And you know, we don't begrudge you that. And we hope we all come out the other side. Okay. But you did mention getting ahead on things, but also the current work that you have coming out. So you mentioned Strange Adventures, Rorschach, Bat and Cat. Let's kind of take them one by one and just talk about them a little bit. The question I want to ask about Strange Adventure, you yourself mentioned it, you know, Adam Strange, Mr. Terrific, not exactly the most household of names, but I think your fans have come to trust you. And have they been responding the same way to Strange Adventures as Mr. Miracle, as Vision? Do you feel like you're connecting with them and they're getting the theme, what you wanted to get across, that the fact that all of a sudden the truth has become subjective in our society?
Yeah, I mean, I think, it's a good question whether they're connecting on the same way as Mr. Miracle is, I don't think people will ever, we'll connect to Strange Adventures like they do to Mr. Miracle, except for like the badassness of Mr. Terrific.
Right.
Because you connect to, because that work is about love, you know, that work's about two people who love each other.
Mm-hmm.
And how how that love helps them escape. And that's a theme that hits you in the gut and the heart. That's what I meant it to do. Whereas Strange Adventures is almost an undermining of this. Adam and Alana are not a healthy couple, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's going to, it's not going to hit people in the same emotional space as Scott and Barta.
Right.
But that's, I mean, it's intentionally made that way. But I think, and it's totally coming to pass. This is a series just as ambitious as Mr. Miracle in both the way it's told and the themes. And as you're seeing, as it's going through, it's a series that talks about, just as Mr. Miracle talked about sort of survival, which I think was really on our minds in 2017, 2018. This is a series that sort of talks about, the idea of like, the myths we create and the lies we create and how we deal with and the damage, which I think is just utterly on our minds right now in 2020.
Right.
Which all three of these works we're about to talk about, I deal with that. So, yeah, I mean, it's coming through. To me, it's a comic that survives because Mitch and Doc drew it so well. I don't think it would work without that art. It's just utterly I'm working on three books that I think the art is perfect on. And I don't know if I've ever had the privilege of just like every issue. It's hard for me to say the art in Strange Avengers is perfect when I can say the same thing about Rorschach or Batcat. It's doing exactly, it's where I want it to be with the audience. It's where I want it to be as a piece of art. I love it. I love it to death, yeah.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned the art, because when it comes to Rorschach, you know, that Jorge Fornes art is so perfect. So I first saw Jorge's art on Hot Lunch Special. The series he did for
going back, stuff. Aftershock, yeah.
Yeah, with Elliot Rahal, and then got a chance to meet Jorge at New York Comic Con. You know, super nice guy. And it's got that, you know, Hot Lunch Special, we've talked about on the podcast before. It's got that crime noir vibe, a little bit of darkness, a little bit of throwback. I'm getting that sort of pulpy feel a little bit from Rorschach already two issues in. You know, it's like that old, you know, gumshoe detective, you know, from the 20s or 30s investigating, maybe a little Columbo thrown in there. So What are some of your non-comic influences that you're pulling from? And is that intentional, or are you going for a little bit of that detective pulpy feel with Rorschach?
I've said this before, so people have heard me. You can tune this part out, but a year and a half, or no? Oh, I guess 2 years ago now. I'm one of my places I go to escape is old movies. I'm like a TCM kind of guy. That's kind of like my nerd. You know, it's what comics almost used to be. Once you're professional in comics, comics can never be pure escape again. Mm-hmm. So I go to
the sausage made.
Yeah, it's not just how the sausage is made. It's if I read something that's really good, I'm jealous of it. If I read something that's bad, I'm mad at it. So there's like a little too much emotion in it.
Right.
But you know, with old movies, I can never make an old movie because that's 80 years. So I'm neither jealous or mad. Mm-hmm. I went to a film noir festival, which is led by a guy named Eddie Muller, who does introductions for TCM and a great show called Noir Alley. And I had dinner with him and a guy named Michael Kronenberg, and we met through John Suntress. And I sat down and they started talking this language about film noir. I know I knew I had watched like, you know, the top 10 film noirs. I knew them, but they were talking in a language I just didn't understand. The way they were talking, the way I talk about comics, where it's like, you know, like John, you know, throwing out there and being like, oh yeah, who do you like, John Buscema or Gil Kane? You know, like which Conan is better? You know, like stuff like normal people wouldn't understand the references to. And I was just drawn into it. It's like, I want to learn this language. Like, I just, like an ambition stirred up inside me. I was like, there's something here I can't put my mind on, but as a storyteller, there was something in these stories that really interested me. So after that dinner, I dedicated literally a year. I was like, I'm taking the next year and I'm going to learn what the fuck, what this is. Mm-hmm. And literally every night of that year, I watched a different, you know, old 40s or 50s noir. I read, you know, all the sort of classic Kane, you know, Chandler novels. This stuff that, you know, Ed Brubaker and Greg Rucker are always talking about. It's like, I want to freaking know what's going on. And after sort of a year doing that, with no intention of ever using it, but just kind of like knowing that there was something there that I wanted to cling to, I started to sort of see the films the way I saw content. And I was like, okay, I can see what's interesting about this, and I can start to use some of it. And I see in both of these three pieces that are putting out, you're seeing a year's work of research of me trying to stir myself as a writer and push myself in a different direction and sort of find a new influence. So yeah, I think you're definitely seeing a lot of that stuff. And it's based in sort of this 40s, 50s film noir stuff.
At what point did you realize that Rorschach would be the right character to tell a story with those kind of influences? Did it happen right away, or was it later on?
Rorschach came to me weirdly. So, after Mitch and I had finished Mr. Miracle, they were talking about we'd do Adam Strange. This exactly what happened was supposed to happen, and Didio texted me out of the blue. I was walking my dog, and he's like, "Forget Adam Strange, nobody cares. Do Rorschach." He's like, "There's a new Watchmen TV show coming. It's gonna blow everyone away. That's the one you want to do." And I was like, "Not only no, but hell no. I'm not gonna. I don't want to." I'm enough of a copycat of Alan Moore in my regular life. I do these 9-panel grids. I talk sad people looking out windows. You know, it's just like, I don't need to be compared to him. I just, it's enough. I love Didio, man. He's made mistakes in his career, sure, whatever. But I just like him as a human being, and he loved comics. And he was actually, he was right and I was wrong, because what happened was when I watched the Watchmen TV show, I saw what I think he was seeing was that show wasn't a copy of Watchmen. It wasn't trying to be Alan Moore again. It was trying to use Alan Moore to talk about, to expand upon it, you know? Mm-hmm. It wasn't just another cover. Because I thought Watchmen TV show would just be boring. I've read the comic. I don't need to see the show. But the show itself was like, okay, Watchmen is a language and we could talk about current issues using that. And that sort of brought my mind. Like, oh, I could do this. And that coincided with almost exact same time with Jorge doing an issue of Batman Annual 4, which is maybe my favorite issue I wrote of Batman, and me realizing that Jorge was a genius, and I just didn't know. I was stupid. It took me a while to see it. And I was like, I need to do a project. And DC, it's a different management team now. But Bob and Dan, who were at DC then, were not so high on Jorge's work. But I knew they wanted me to do this project. So I was like, if I do this project, can I work with Jorge? And they're like, okay, fine. And I was like, oh, I'm in. Like and so that's sort of that's how it started. And in terms of the Yes, I mean, this is how anything happens. Like, I'm using the Watchmen TV show. I have Jorge's art. I have this year of doing this noir stuff. And then I start sort of playing around. And then I'm, if you read Rorschach, I'm obsessed with comic book history, like most comic book creators of my generation. And so, I was reading an old comics journal that was like all about Steve Ditko, and all that stuff combined into one to become this mesh up of what Rorschach is. Yeah. It was like all those different sort of influences.
Yeah. And for, you know, older fans like me who like yourself, you know, who are fascinated with the creators of yesteryear, it's great to see those references. I don't know if you've been reading Donny Cates' crossover, but he's doing it with even, you know, creators now, you know, mentioning Scott Snyder and Chip Zdarsky and stuff like that. It's a real celebration. So that's awesome as well. But it's a good reminder for any aspiring, I know we have a lot of aspiring creators that listen to our show. It's a good reminder that don't get so focused on output and creating things that you forget to take things in, because we all need to recharge our batteries and make sure that we're, you know, pulling inspiration from things that we love. It's where the passion comes from.
Yeah, I remember when I was first learning how to write, one of the things I did was I listened to as many interviews with the creators as I possibly could. And I was listening to a podcast that Alan Moore did when he would do podcasts back in 2006 or something. And they asked him, like, are you annoyed that so many people are influenced by you? And he's like, no. I love that people are, you should be influenced by people. He's like, just don't be just influenced by me. And I thought that was incredibly great advice. Where you're like, oh, that's how you make something creative. You don't just say, okay, that one guy, I want to do what he's doing and just copy it. You're like, okay, I like what that one guy's doing. I like what that other woman is doing. I like what he's doing over that other country. Let's combine all three of these things together and make something new and different. Like, be influenced by lots of different people. Expand your horizons, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Bat and Cat, the other Batman, Catwoman, the other series you have coming out around. We've just seen one issue, but the Clayman art, man, wow, absolutely spectacular.
Oh, pretty. My God, that guy. Yeah, he's good. He's the best there is. He's the best there is at what he does.
Been criminally underrated for a really long time. What I want to ask you about Bat and Cat is you're really telling a story in different timelines, right? So. Yeah. That's something that we've kind of seen you always like to challenge yourself. I've heard you, we've had conversations, you tell me you never want to tell a story in the same way, you always want to keep pushing yourselves. So where did that idea come from, that we really want to focus on Batman and Catwoman, but kind of in three different time periods?
Well, I look at my books, and they're not written in ways intentionally, but they tend to come in generations. And this generation of books, Batcat, Rorschach, and Strange Adventures, none of them are told linearly. Strange Adventures is two timelines simultaneously that you're seeing. Rorschach is told in the Citizen Kane flashback manner of one guy sort of piecing together the story, and you kind of flashing back to different aspects of the story. And then Batcat is told three different timelines at once. So yeah, for these current books, I was like, forget it. I'm just not telling one thing after another. I'm gonna do something more. I was really, after being on Batman for 85 issues and Heroes in Crisis, I was looking to throw away the habits that had gotten me. So I was like, okay, this is what got me to where I am. And now I'm just gonna throw those away and try to build something. You know, you wanna be the Beatles. You want the next album to be in the same genre as the last album, but be different, to be an evolution. You know, you don't want to just put out, you know, you don't want to be the Monkees, just put out the same volume again and again. Evolve is a wrong word, but you want to be better each time. And without losing who you are, because what's the point of that? You know, nobody wants to listen to, you know, U2's Poke album, you know? So as part of evolving, I tried to, one of the things, you know, to challenge myself was, yeah, to get rid of sort of structural storytelling. This came from, I mean, this is a direct copy of True Detective season 3. If you guys haven't seen that, it's a great season of that show. And they were using three timelines. Clay and I had come up with the general plot for the book. And I was watching that show, and I was like, I love what this is doing. I love the effect of seeing characters when they're young, characters in the present, characters when they're old. So you kind of see cause and effect in a different way. I was just digging how that show is put together. And I was like, I wonder if we could do it with this show, this comic. And then I remember that people come up to me, they say your favorite issues. One of the big favorite issues is Batman Annual 2 that I wrote, which takes place first date, last date, basically. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I had created these two time periods where, you know, right after their first date, when she's still a criminal and he's young and they're just super, you know, in that first fire of romance. And then I had created this thing where, they're old and Batman has sort of this ideal death where he dies of old age and sort of what happens next. And I was like, oh, I have these timelines. They're already established in my run. And Clay and I had already come up with the plot for the present day. So I was like, okay, we're gonna let all three of those run at once. And that's when Batcap became from what it started as, which was just supposed to be sort of this sort of end cap to my run, to something much more ambitious, to sort of a story of 50 years of these people's lives and their effect on each other. And sort of how people grow together and grow apart over a lifetime. It became a much bigger story once I added that element.
Well, that's interesting that it's evolved and become a bigger story in kind of its own series now, because originally, like you said, it was going to be the cap to your run. You were hoping to do 100 issues of Batman. So, I mean, do you think everything worked out for the best? Is there anything with your Batman run you'd go back and change or do different? Do you even ever look back on your old work and think about things like that?
No, I don't know. I mean, that's a great, I mean, yeah, no, I'm a man who lives with a lot of regrets. I live with guilt. I'm not the kind of guy who's like, man, that was everything I wrote was the best thing I ever wrote. I'm always like, oh man, I could have made that better. I could have done this. I should have done that. Oh, I made a mistake here or something. I mean, I feel like there are issues of Batman where I hit heights I never hit before. I did incredibly experimental stuff on that book. I told an issue backwards. I did a silent issue. I did a huge epic war. I did surreal. There was an issue where Batman and Catwoman are dancing for the entire issue. It was like a musical number issue. I'm insanely proud of that run. I could have always made it better. My regret, and I don't even think it was avoidable, was because of the schedule. I always people, what's your great theme of Batman? I was like, my theme of Batman is that I hit my deadlines. Because it was double shipped, the best-selling book on the stacks, and a rule I made at the beginning where I wasn't going to have multiple artists tell the same story. Mm-hmm. So if I got an art shift, I was going to shift the story to fit the artist. So you wouldn't have like one issue with Mikael and one issue with David and the one issue with Tony and just like all kind of muddle. Although that's what City of Bane became. Because of that, I never sort of could do something like I'm saying with Batcat, where as ambitious as Mr. Miracle or Vision or something, because I could never sort of to do something really ambitious, to do something that's like timeless forever, you and an artist have to meld, because I'm not an artist, I can't draw. Like, you have to meld in a sort of way, and it has to have a consistency in that art, and it has to have a consistency with the editorial. And of course, when you're on the biggest book, especially back then, it's not as much in DC now, but you know, editorial was very strong, and so you need a certain amount of freedom. So I never, to me, my one regret is I never sort of got the freedom to make something's truly as ambitious, but with Batcat, I'm getting to do that. So no complaints there. That was it. If that makes any sense.
You're talking about that guilt. You remind me of myself, you know, growing up Catholic, there's always that
guilt. Oh, yeah.
That Catholic guilt they talk about. So kind of the same thing about, I have the same question about Heroes in Crisis. You know, we know that the things got leaked early and it just felt like should have been something, and then maybe it wasn't. What are your thoughts looking back on that series?
I love it. I have no regrets on that series. I love it to death. Some people don't dislike it for this reason or that reason, and they're wrong. people come up to me, they say this really, the thing I most regret about the series is the title sucks. Heroes in Crisis is a crappy title. I wish I had called it Sanctuary.
Yeah.
Which would have been a much better title, and I think would have done it a lot of good. But besides that, I mean, that book makes me laugh. I love the Booster stuff in it. I love the Harley stuff in it. I like how I wrote those characters. I think some of my best writing is in there in those confessionals. And Clay's art is beyond. It's beyond. Just look at the freaking art in that book. Look at the splash page with the flowers. And yeah, I'm incredibly proud of that book. I have no regrets.
Yeah, and I think you know, as a fan, as a comic fan first and a fan of yours, I think it succeeded. And I love the fact that we see ramifications. Even now we're seeing ramifications of that story, like in Scott's death metal series. You know, we're seeing things with Wally that are still unraveling with that. It's so deep.
I think there was something, I've said this before, there's something I didn't understand about comics back then. And I think people tried to warn me. And I'm not saying I regret this, but like afterwards I was reading, what is his name? It was a famous screenwriter, has a famous screenwriting book. And he talks about a movie he made with Robert Redford. And it's a movie Robert Redford plays a pilot, like a stunt pilot. And in the beginning of the stunt pilot, he's with a lady on the plane, and she falls off and dies, and he kind of has the guilt of that and for the whole time. And he poured his heart and soul into this movie, and it came out. He went in the theater, and people didn't like it. And he's like, I can't figure out why people don't like this movie. Like, I think this is good. I've written good movies, and this was a good one. And it occurred to him, he's like, people could not accept that Robert Redford went out on a plane, you know, like on a wing of a plane to save a lady, and she fell. Like if that was Robert De Niro or Al Pacino or somebody, but Robert Redford was their American hero, and it just didn't occur to them that could happen. And so it created a dissonance inside them. And I think that happened with Wally West. Like I did not realize that Wally West was he was like a Robert Redford-esque figure. I had in my head, what he did was not good, but people make mistakes.
Yeah.
And especially people, that was part of it. Like this wasn't a book about like, oh, life is hard, but it's going to get better. It's like, sometimes when life is hard, you make a mistake, you mess up, and you have to deal with the fact that you made that mistake. I think anybody knows when you go through a traumatic thing, it's not just the pain on you, but it turns you into a person sometimes you don't want to be. And then once that happens, how do you come back from it? And I wanted to write about that. And I think writing about that with Wally West, who had just gone through this sort of rebirth thing and had become a symbol of things, I kind of didn't know. He became sort of a Robert Redford-esque figure. So I guess maybe in that way, I kind of regret. Maybe if we'd done it with a character who didn't have that much symbolism attached to him. Maybe if I'd done it with Robert De Niro, it would have been better.
Robert De Niro in Sanctuary. That would have been great. Well, you've read a couple holiday stories too.
Bunch. And I love holiday stories.
Yeah, what are some of your favorites? Talk about the ones that you've written. You just did a Lobo one for the multiverse.
Special. Did you read it? Nobody read it.
No, I read it. I read the.
You're the first person I've talked to. It's one of those books that comes out. You like look online. You're like, oh, nobody even saw this.
Dolphins, man. So I, you know, in the interest of full disclosure, I'm not a big fan of Lobo, but you know, I did read it. But the part I loved is where Lobo talks about, I'm doing this all for the fish. Okay, well, maybe it's 50-50. Okay, well, maybe it's 80-20. Wait, what are we fighting? I'm not a big fan of Lobo, but to me, that you nailed the quintessential essence of Lobo right there. That was awesome. And my other favorite holiday story of yours is the Jewish soldier of World War II, very like Joe Kubert inspired with the Nazi. So those are my two favorites. Talk a little bit about the holiday stories, how much you like them, and what are some of your favorites that others have done? Do you have any that stand out?
Others, Neil Adams' famous Everybody Sings story sticks out in my head.
Silent Night, yeah.
Yeah, Silent Night. Louise Simonson did some stuff, both in Power Pack and X Factor did some holiday stuff, which I loved as a kid. What are the great sort of comic book holiday stories?
Did you ever read it's in Captain America 50 by Dan Jurgens. That's a silent, like there's literally not a word in the whole story. It's kind of.
No, I don't think I've read that. I know there's one by Mark Waid. It's like where the Red Skull, and that's all silent.
Yeah, there's that. And then there's the famous Enemy Ace.
Oh, Christmas Eve. Yeah, the Enemy Ace Christmas Eve story. That's a great one. Yeah, that one I do know. With, again, Joe Kubert.
Yeah.
I love those old stories. I love them.
Do you have to come from a different headspace when you, because you're writing, it's not even the holiday season when you're writing those normally, right? Just like when they film TV episodes, it's like August and they're filming their Christmas episode.
Well, Batcat it all takes place like 10 days before Christmas, leading up to Christmas Day. So the whole thing is Christmas themed. which is one of the reasons I did the Lobo Hanukkah story, so I could balance out a little bit. My mother's Jewish, my father's Christian. I was raised with both Hanukkah and Christmas. Although I was raised by my Jewish mother, because my dad left early, but she was super into Christmas. She loved it. So that was like, Christmas was the biggest thing in my house and is the biggest thing in my house. I named my kid, I have my youngest son is named Crosby. His name's Crosby King. And it's like, why is my name Crosby? I was like, because when I was a kid and I listened to Bing Crosby music, that was just the happiest feeling I ever got in my life. When I just sit there and listen to White Christmas and it was just cold outside and I just felt warm inside. I was like, oh, you named me after the Christmas feeling? I was like, yeah, I named you after the Christmas feeling, Crosby. That's that thing. So that's a, I won an Eisner for my Batman Christmas story, which I did about his dog, mm-hmm. about a rescue dog.
Yeah, you and David Finch, right?
Me and Finch, yeah. With Finch inking himself on that issue. It was the only time he inked himself, Batman. I did the winter special, another Eisner Award. I should just do the holiday stories with Jay Fabok, which I guess wasn't a holiday story, it was a winter special, but it felt sort of holiday-ish to me.
Yep, also won best short story.
Yeah, and I like doing short stories. Those are some of my favorite things to do. I love the challenge of it. I've got started in this industry of the short story, right? I think it's probably my strongest trait is I know how to write a good comic book short story. It reminds me when I write them how to write. Because if you can get a good story in 8 pages, you can expand upon that. It teaches you how to write if you can do it in 8 pages. But the new one that's out. So that started. So Keith Giffen, who I adore, anyone who's read Omega Men and Mr. Miracle sees the 3 Year Later Legion influence on that stuff. And Keith's one of my favorite writer artists of all time, and the best person to be on a panel, and just someone I like just personally he's a wonderful crank. And he reached out and said he wanted to do a story with me. And I gave him 5 different pitches, all of which were built around Keith Giffen characters, you know. So I did like an ice and fire pitch. I can't even remember them all, you know. But the stupidest one was I was like, we'll do a Lobo Hanukkah special with Lobo as Judas Maccabee, where he's, because if people don't know Hanukkah, it's like there's a Braveheart story that's behind it, where it's like a guy gets denied a place to worship and then he leads a rebellion against them. And so I was like, let's do that. But it's Lobo and the Fish. I was like, he'll never take that one. That's freaking crazy. And that was the one Keith picked as the one of all the ideas. So I wrote it for Keith. Keith had it. He had things come up, so he couldn't do it. So Scott Koblish took over and made it beautiful. But I adore that story. Nobody freaking read it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'll say that. It's fun. And like I said, even if you're not a fan of Lobo like me, you still get the essence. You get the essence of it. So I especially think that if you're Jewish and you know the story of Judas Maccabee, then you're going to get a lot more out of it. But the other thing that I felt about it was the fact that you have the actual, you know, old language, the King James version of language. It did elevate it in a way. It gives it that sense of, you know, that sort of old, you know, kind of flowery language where you get just that sense of grandeur. So I like that as well, because let's face it, you know, at the end of the day, at least from a Christianity standpoint or Jewish standpoint, you're talking about, you know, the story of the birth of Christ. There isn't a grandeur to that story. There should be. I'm at least, you know, growing up Catholic, there always was, at least when I played one of the 3 wise men in the Christmas play year after year. It felt that way, for sure. But we're kind of mentioning Eisners here. Is it 9 or 10? Do you actually know? Should I put you on the spot here? Do you know how many it is?
Well, I have them right here. I can point to them. I have 7 Eisners. I can see.
7? Because I thought it was.
I have 7 Eisners and.
Oh, yeah. I guess it is.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8. I think 8 Ringos, 6 or 3, and a Harvey.
So still a little ways to go to catch Alan Moore, the aforementioned.
Frank Miller's, I've told this story before, but the first time I met Frank Miller, I just won two Eyes News. And Jim Lee and Frank and I were getting together to work on possibly completing up All-Star Batman and Robin. And Jim was, at the first time I met Frank, he's trying to impress Frank, like, why'd you bring in this schmuck? And he's like, Tom just won two Eisners last night. And Frank's like, pause. I think I have 21. Like, okay. Yeah. Just drop exactly. The mic in my face.
Yeah, I think Jill Thompson, I think, has 13. Miller, 20.
I was sitting with Jill when she won three of them.
And then, yeah, Alan's in the lead with 26. I don't know that anybody's ever going to come close to that. It's just, it's amazing.
I think you have your moments, your sort of award year moments, and I've had mine. So I think I might be done for a while. And I'm perfectly content because, as Darwin Cook famously said, you only need one. So
that's right. You get one, and then you can forever be, you know, Eisner Award winning in front of your name.
I was lucky enough to win a Harvey before they got all weird, so I can always say Harvey Award winning. Because Harveys have gotten, they only have one comic book category of like the seven they give out, so they're really hard to win now.
Yeah, they are. And I feel bad for the...
Not that I care, it's not about the awards.
No, it's not about the awards. And you know what, I feel like, you know, everybody, it's sort of such a cliche, it's so great to even be nominated, but it's so true. And going to the Eisner ceremony and sitting there and experience it, you know, especially as a nominee, and that's why I feel so bad for the people that were nominated for this year. They didn't get to go and experience that. So I was just thinking about it earlier today, because I'm actually later today, I'm going to be talking to Joe Henderson, who did the Sky. He's the showrunner for Lucifer, and he had Skyward from Image that was nominated for this year, 2020, for Best New Series. And we had plans to go celebrate while we were in San Diego, and it just didn't happen. I was thinking, you know, hopefully those people get to experience that at some point when conventions come back, because, you know, you've experienced it, and it's just a good celebration of comics. Such a fun night.
But I will say, I think it is better when you get nominated and you lose. It's just such a terrible feeling. Like this year, I didn't get nominated for anything. I didn't lose anything. I was like, okay, I can just enjoy it. It was like, it was nice to have it not be stressful. So I gotta write shitty so I don't get nominated again. So I'll do my best. I'll do a few more Heroes in Crisis where I choose the Robert Redford character.
Well, I know you can't talk about anything that you have coming up, but we know you have your next series already completed. Other things in the can that you've written. I do want to touch on, you mentioned the New Gods film, and you know, you talked a little bit about how for the most part, the film industry is shut down. There are a few things that are still in production. Were you at a place where you further along in the development, far enough along in the development of New Gods that this pandemic impacted, or did things kind of keep moving in the right direction?
No, well, we're moving in the right direction. No, I don't think a pandemic affected New Gods at all, as far as I can tell. Yeah, I'm co-writing this with Ava DuVernay, one of the true geniuses of America right now, pop culture, and she's just doing 1,000 things. And when you're doing 1,000 things, each thing takes time, and she's trying to make it the best. So it's just taking time. I mean, that's all it is. I like the script. I mean, it's hard. I've never written a movie before, so I'm trying to make it as good as I can make it. It's like anything in writing. Like, you start off hating it, and then you read it and you start to like it. And as soon as you start to like it, then people make you change it. And you're like, oh, but I just fell in love with this thing. You know?
We all know filmmaking is such a process. There's so much money involved, and you know, you end up getting a lot of cooks in the kitchen. So I mean, it's one of the things that I love about comics. You get an idea, 2 months later you've got the finished product. You know, films, it's like 2.5, 3, 4, 5 years maybe, who knows.
I mean, having dipped my toe in sort of the Hollywood stuff now, comics are they're the most fun medium to work in. They have the best fans, this is where I want to be, and writing comics is what I want to do. At this point, like, I I could do more of that TV stuff, but I prefer the comics. It's more fun.
Yeah, and you mentioned the fans, and you know, we started off by wishing everybody, you know, happy holidays and talking about some of the things that we like, and we hope that they're taken advantage of during this lockdown as well. You have had a chance to do some virtual shows this year, and I know the vibe must be different connecting with the fans, but does it still give you a boost to do those things and know that you're getting feedback and fans are listening?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's incredibly rewarding to just get out there and get questions, but it's nothing near a convention. I do miss, I mean, there's something, because we work, you know, and so, we started talking about how, like, what a gift it is to comic books that we work in isolation, we can make product. But because of that, you can kind of forget that anybody reads these books, you know, mm-hmm. You know, that when a book sells 200,000 copies, that's like, all those Yankee stadiums piled up on top of it. It feels like meaningless to you when you're just like, you know, stuck at home every day. And conventions make it real. People come up to you and they talk to you and they say, this meant to me, or Tom, you're a piece of crap, or, you know, it's, and as a comic, yeah, it charges you up. It makes you, and also just to be surrounded by just everyone, like, oh, I want to buy that. I love that. Here's this big thing. Like that energy of like, oh, that nerd energy. Just, I love it. Conventions are some of my favorite places. I used to get in trouble when I did conventions because I was never at my table, because I was always like, oh man, I want to go check that out. I want to go look at that original art. I want to go to that panel and see that guy talk about things. So it's wonderful to do Zoom conferences and to see the fans, but boy, do I miss conventions. I miss seeing people in person.
Yeah, at first I was kind of the same way, because, you know, much like yourself, you know, they are work for me. You know, I'm there as press and I'm doing interviews and covering panels and writing articles and stuff. But still, my worst day at Comic-Con, I'm still, you know, at Comic-Con. And
yeah,
there's something to be said for that, and just celebrating the things that we love. And it doesn't even have to be the same thing. Somebody might be at Comic-Con for things that I'm not interested in, anime or, you know, whatever, cosplay. And, you know, but they're still happy to be there, just like I am. There's lots to be said for that. It's joyous.
I still remember my first Comic-Con, which I you know, even though I grew up in LA, I didn't go to comic conventions ever. Because I was so scared. I was scared that people would find out I was a nerd, you know. It was like, I didn't want to, I was, what if I went there and my friends saw me, and, you know, I was as stupid as that was. So I didn't go to conventions until I started coming back to comics, like 2010. And I remember my first San Diego and just going there and being like, oh, I feel at home here almost, you know. It's like, oh, among my people, you know, like everywhere you look, people are excited about things I'm excited about. There's an energy to it.
Yeah, it's definitely a good time. So we all look forward to the return of that. Well, as we're wrapping up here, Tom, let's talk a little bit about holiday traditions. You mentioned what a big thing Christmas was for your mom and you growing up, and now it's a big thing in your house. What are some of your favorite traditions that you've maybe you even started back when it was you and your mom that you've brought to your house that you and your family and your kids look forward to this time of year?
My mother preferred a very messy Christmas tree. Like, we didn't have just like, you know, red balls or something. She preferred, like, as she traveled or did anything, she collected Christmas ornaments as like souvenirs to be like, oh, we went to Disneyland, here's a Mickey Mouse. And so when you open the Christmas ornaments every year, it was almost like opening up like a treasure chest full of your life, you know, like, oh, here's your baby's first ornament from when. And my mother has passed away 8 years or something. So I inherited her Christmas ornaments. And then, of course, you know, I have my own kids. So every year we go out before Christmas. We couldn't do it this year, but we go to a mall and we, you know, we got to get them. That sort of reflect like, oh, my kid's really into wrestling, so he's going to get a John Cena, you know, or my daughter's really into Friends, so she's going to get a Joey or Phoebe. And like, so you kind of see in the past. And so like this year we did it on Amazon, just be like, okay, pick that. But like, so we're going to do that tomorrow. We're going to open the box and see like, okay, this is when you were five, this was the ornament you picked, and this is what you were like. So, but, and you can, you know, cause I have my mom's ornament, I can be like, and when I was five, this is the Smurf one I got, you know? So it just continues. So my Christmas tree is a mess of jumble, but it's a jumble of memories. You know?
Wow. That's amazing. It's like you're opening a time capsule every year.
Yeah. I love it. And yeah, you put the, you know, the Bing Crosby music on in the background. It's just, you get that feeling.
Bing, I was reading an article about Bing Crosby recently, actually, and I didn't know this, but he had like more charting song, more records that hit the charts than like Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley combined, and far and away the most like number one records of all time, like 46, more than the Beatles, more than anybody. And I just, those are records I think that are never going to be topped, because music's so much more diverse now. It's a different kind of animal, and I think people forget what an influence that guy was even now. And so when you mentioned, you know, naming your son after him, what an incredible talent and legacy.
I should be clear, he was not the best human being on earth.
Yes.
He was a shit father, and not the best. Sinatra was even worse, but like Crosby, he was a crap father, and he was progressive on some things, but I think if you looked at him now, he would definitely be in the racist category of human beings. So I don't want to idealize him, but I do, there is a part of him that represents, you know, because I come from a city and this, a family of divorce, and there's a part of him that represents sort of this Norman Rockwell America that I, mm-hmm. that I still feel like lives in my heart. And it's not about, you know, being like that stupid ideal 50s family, but it's about that American ideal of a family, however you constitute family, be it friends or whatever, that come together to support each other, and you know, those four freedoms and all that stuff that I think is just the core essential. That really comes out of Christmas that I really like.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And we need that so much right now, to remember that we're more alike than not. As Americans, we're more alike than different. There's so much divisiveness right now. It's terrible. Yeah. How about we all just take a breath, celebrate Christmas, celebrate being together in whatever safe way you can do that with your family. And we'll all look forward to a safe and more sane 2021, hopefully.
I couldn't agree more, but it's tough, you know. I gotta shop for my, we're 2 weeks ahead of the Christmas. I know it's coming up. But I got, you know, I'm still shopping for my wife. And I was like, you normally, if you can't think of anything, get your wife. Like, okay, I'll get her like tickets to something, but can't even go anywhere.
Yeah.
Oh, man, this is the worst. This is a husband disaster. It's Christmas in terms of, and like, our anniversary is in March when this first started. And I got her like a fancy leather coat for her to wear out. Of course, we haven't left the house since March, you know? It's like, I can't even get her some other fancy, like, what am I going to get her? Oh, here's some earrings you can wear to nothing, you know? It's like, so I don't know. Maybe I'll get her slippers.
Yeah, and I know it's even worse for you, you know, living in DC. You're kind of at the heart of all the madness, so maybe it's good that you're not leaving the house, so to speak.
It is. Yeah, I walk my dog around the Capitol, and we have the protesters are out now, and they're all, you know, they're not wearing masks, and they're yelling as loud as you can, and you have this instinct, you're like, man, I gotta take a picture because this is a weird historical moment where these people are doing a weird thing, but you're like, no, I don't want to get near them because they could kill me, you know? So
it's, yeah,
like, it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, they won't wear masks, but they should probably all be wearing tinfoil hats with their crazy.
Yeah, but yeah, they're, I live right next to the Supreme Court. I could hear them if I listened that loud enough, them just screaming.
Crazy. Well, let's finish up with one last question, Tom. What are you looking forward to in other than a more safe and sane 2021? Anything on the horizon, new projects that you're getting to announce? Anything that stands out yet for you in 2021?
I mean, I'm just at the beginning of a lot of my projects, so I'm looking forward to Rorschach coming out. Rorschach we're so far ahead on because I think it'll be the first Watchmen related project that comes out on time, all 12 issues. So we're going for the record. So I'm looking forward to people reading that and reading where that series goes. The same with Batcat, the same with Strange Adventures, we're only halfway through. So all that stuff. And yeah, I guess I'm looking forward to them announcing these next series that I've already written most of. And I have this TV series. I've been working on it for 5 years. Sometimes it looks like it's a go. Sometimes it doesn't look like it's a go. When it gets announced, it'll be a big deal if it is a go. And so I'm looking forward to that. And you know what I'm looking forward to, man? When you're young, you have great fantasies about like, oh, if I'm president or if I marry the girl of my dreams or whatever it is. My fantasy now is just like some convention. It's 10 o'clock at night. Me and Mitch are at a bar. We'll get a drink. Clay comes up. Doc rolls up. We sit there. We complain about our editors. And we're just like sitting in a bar, having a drink with my friends and laughing. Oh my God. Yeah. That's my greatest fantasy right now.
Right.
That just sounds so good to me. I can taste the whiskey. I can feel like, and then, hey, where do you want to go after this? I don't know. You want to go, should we go get a steak? Let's go get a steak. And I was like, yeah, that's my greatest fantasy, is some dank bar and next to a convention center.
Nothing wrong with that, man. I think we all definitely miss our friends. I'm also looking forward to, both for my own sanity, because, you know, I can't imagine with three, but I just have my one daughter here. I'm looking forward to her going back to school. both so that she stops driving me crazy, lets me work, but also for her sake, you know, I feel like she's missing out on stuff, you know, growing up, social internet. I mean, we never went through anything like this when we were kids growing up, and I feel so bad, especially for kids that have missed things like prom and graduations and things like that. It's terrible.
I'm a weird person that I have gone through a similar thing to this, because I did a year of when I was 26, 27. I did a year on the Afghan PAC border area, the hunt in
Bin Laden. Oh, that's true. Yeah.
And I was stuck in a house. We only left to go out and do raids and stuff. And it was an endurance test, just like this, where it was kind of like, there were some days where you're just like, okay, it's me and my DVD collection and I got to make it to tomorrow. And there were some days where you're like, holy shit, am I going to die? You know, like it was very similar to this for a whole year. So I have, and I would say, you know, for a guy who wrote it, there's going to be a psychological impact on this we don't even understand yet, you know? So, but yeah, I can't wait for my kids to get back. Especially my littlest one, like I was talking about before, my two older ones are pretty nerdy. They don't mind being home looking at a computer, but my 6-year-old, he needs to play with his friends. I feel so bad that he can't get out there and play with his friends. So just to see him, you know, in DC here, they haven't been in school since March. And I don't think they're going to be in school till September. But yeah, just the idea of him, of going and seeing him at a playground with his friends playing a game, man, that's like utopia to me. I feel like I miss that. I mean, I'm lucky because there are three of them can play together. So at least I have that. But I can't wait till I see my 6-year-old just in a preschool class making up some stupid game and doing it.
Yeah, agreed. Well, happy holidays to you and your family, Tom. I'm glad to hear that everybody's happy and healthy. Thank you so much for your time and for spreading some good cheer to all the fans out there. I know how much you appreciate all your fans and all the support and the fact that everybody loves to read the things that you're creating.
I create really weird things. So the fact that people keep coming back, I'm the luckiest man alive there's no end to that sentence. I am the luckiest man alive. I do what I want. I have a perfect job. I have a beautiful family and we're happy and safe. So I'm grateful to the fans. I'm gratefully blessed and Merry Christmas.
All right, everybody. That's going to do it for this episode of The Comic Source. As always, want to thank everybody for listening and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.